It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Job Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning. Morning.
We're going to be on for an hour today. Cool.
We wish.
Unfortunately, people will only hear the first half hour.
Half hour version.
But you'll be on for an hour, yes.
Yeah. With a 7-day break in the middle.
That's right. You do the math. All right. Well, speaking of math, things didn't add up for a lot of people working on the Mercer Street mess.
Yeah, no, things didn't pencil out for the Mercer Corridor Beautification Project this week, did they, Job?
They penciled out just fine in terms of the city portion of the money, and that's because I think there's a technical term for this. I think it's called prevarication. why don't you explain what that means?
That's the fancy word for somebody lied. Yes, indeed. About a week ago, Greg Nichols told the City Council Transportation Committee that there were some federal economic stimulus funds coming for the Mercer Corridor Beautification Project, and he asked that they vote to release the funding to lift the limits on the funding for the project so the construction could start. And the City Council Transportation Committee voted to do that, and then on Monday of this week, the full City Council voted to do the same.
Which raises the question, what did Greg Nichols know, and when did he know it?
Because, according to the House Chair of the House Transportation Committee, Judy Cliburn, in the state legislature, she says that she had told Greg Nichols and Jan Drago that there would be no money coming for either the Mercer Corridor project or the Spokane Street Viaduct, and that all of the state transportation funds from the economic stimulus bill were going to go to state-owned and state-maintained highways, particularly for repaving, and a lot of it, something like 40%, would go for repaving and filling potholes, and that none of it would go to these big, you know, showboat city projects.
And also the city projects are on city-owned streets. They're not technically state concerns because they're not state highways.
Yeah, so what it comes down to is, did Greg Nichols forget? No, I think he probably was manipulating the city council.
Yeah, basically what we have here is that the city council was tricked, essentially, into releasing a boatload of money for a beautification project for Paul Allen by Greg Nichols when Nichols knew full and well that the matching funds that the city council was relying on in order to make this a construction project that could actually be completed were not forthcoming. Nichols lied. Simple as that. And he lied to promote his best friend Paul Allen, and he lied in order to do it for a project that should not be a major transportation priority.
Yeah. And Nichols claimed, well, oh, the governor promised me the funds. Well, excuse me, but he is not a political neophyte. He knows how the process works, that the governor makes proposals and the legislature decides what to do with those proposals. And if the House Transportation Committee chair tells you that the money's not there for it, you can pretty much guarantee the money's not there. So the governor promised the funds to me explanation is complete and utter
the dog doo-doo. Ate my homework.
right. So what needs to happen now is the city council has to get together and vote to reimpose the restrictions on the funding for the Mercer Corridor project. And hopefully, I would love this to happen. I hope they take a closer look at it and decide to scrap the whole project altogether.
Yeah, and I would really encourage folks on Monday to call their city councilman and encourage them to put a hold back on that money.
Yes.
All right, moving on. Speaking of Mayor Nichols, one of the potential people to run against him had an exploratory committee looking at things last week.
And this week, he decided, after all, not to run. Tim Burgess, who's only been on council for a couple of years and is the most conservative member of city council, the former policeman, decided that, quote, there are many, many things where Greg Nichols and I are in sync, unquote. he formed his Explorer Committee, went to all the downtown business money and discovered that, hey, guess what? They all like what Greg Nichols is doing for them just fine. Thank you very much. It also makes me wonder what kind of there's nothing about Greg Nickels' political track record that would make you think cynically like this, but what kind of deal Nickels and Burgess cut, particularly because this will be Nickels' third term if he doesn't want to be mayor forever, which, admittedly is a long shot, but in case he doesn't want to be mayor forever, did he promise his support to Tim Burgess 4 or 8 years from now in exchange for not running right now? That kind of backdoor deal between two people who are ideologically pretty similar and draw their financial support from the same business community is not at all inconceivable, and it stinks to high heaven. And it does raise another question: who is going to run against Greg Nickels? Because this is a guy that polling has repeatedly shown would be vulnerable to a well-funded challenge, particularly from the left around development issues and environmental issues. But nobody, at least none of the obvious people who have the credentials and the name recognition to pose a serious challenge, has stepped forward as yet. And it's just inconceivable that somebody with Nickels' political vulnerabilities is going to get to a third term with a second term not facing any kind of a serious challenge.
All right. Moving on, but sticking with Greg Nickels, an update on a place called Nickelsville.
Yeah, Nickelsville, named after Greg Nickels because the homeless population of this city keeps growing and keeps getting harassed by Nickels and his police department. They are looking this week once again at moving. There was a city-imposed deadline for their latest home at the corner of 45th and 15th Northeast in the University District. They're now going to be moving to an unincorporated area between Renton and Seattle and unincorporated King County at Bryn Mawr United Methodist Church. That'll be next Thursday, so if anybody wants to help out with their moves, it would very much be appreciated. And they're hoping that this will be the final move before they go to this will be another 3 month stint before they go to what they hope will be their permanent home. And again, it's a permanent testimony to Nickels' really cruel and probably in many ways illegal harassment of the homeless population of this city.
All right. And an item that you had meant to cover last week, but I hopped over it accidentally, the Seattle Central students.
Yeah, there's a big controversy brewing at Seattle Central. Seattle Central, as with many higher education institutions, facing pretty severe budget shortfalls. And the way SECC is handling it is to target classes that are pretty central to its core mission. The first ones to go have been foreign language classes, and this is at a community college, for anybody who's been on the campus there, that is largely non-white, heavily toward immigrant populations, a very multi-ethnic mix of students learning to make their way in the world, and the idea that you would cut out the program that encourages people to know about other cultures, that encourages people to be able to make their way not just in this country but in the world is really kind of inconceivable. But there's a student group that's fighting this, there are faculty members that are fighting this, and they're very much looking for support from the community too.
All right.
And they've had several rallies and events and things that will continue that are I think open to the public as well.
Moving on to our state legislature, and what is HB 2002?
HB 2002 may get the Greenwash of the Year award. It is the official title of it is, quote, an act relating to the generation of electricity in carbonless energy parks. Well, you may ask, what is a carbonless energy park? Well, fortunately, a subsection of this law, because it is, after all, a law and has to have the legalese in it, defines what a carbonless energy park is. Quote, carbonless energy park means an unfinished site for a nuclear power project that is located east of the crest of the Cascade Mountains and is partially or wholly developed to provide... I can't read my writing here. provide electricity with a production capacity of not less than 10 megawatts. In other words, it is specifically defining not just nuclear power, but the four abandoned WHOOPS plants that it wants to restart as nuclear power plants. This may get the euphemism of the year award. A carbonless energy park is a phrase that is specifically meant to deceive the public as to what it is about, and I'm sure that whoever came up with it got got a nice bonus for thinking of it because it sounds so innocuous and so wonderful. But what they're really talking about is a bill to restart nuclear power and the WHIPS projects in Washington State.
All right.
That's crazy. That is crazy.
Moving on to national, and it looks like in terms of the U.S. Commerce Secretary, third time is the charm.
Yeah, well, you know, Gary rather Locke, I've forgotten Gary his Locke. Name already. Has
you
been.
You can't forget clean-cut, nerdy Gary Locke.
Oh, yes, I can, because in 8 years as governor of Washington State, he did absolutely nothing significant. But he is, in case anybody wasn't paying close attention during the presidential campaign and thought that Barack Obama might be somehow critical of NAFTA or free trade agreements, well, you can put that to rest, because Gary Locke there are basically two reasons why he was tapped as Commerce Secretary, a fairly obscure ex-governor of a mid-sized state. One is that he is a relentless booster of free trade and counts heavily in his resume that he promoted free trade with Washington State and particularly around the Pacific Rim countries. The other thing that he has going for him, of course, is that he and, about 2 billion other people share some vague past ancestry with the people who now own the United States government, lock, stock, and barrel. But if Gary Locke does anything similar in his job as Commerce Secretary to what he did as governor of Washington State, you can look for absolutely no new policy initiatives, nothing that will rock the boat in terms of any kind of questioning of the heavy reliance on quote-unquote free trade that has come to dominate U.S. trade policy over the last 15 years.
Yeah, and it's interesting that the business community loves the appointment of Gary Locke, and for good reason. He's Mr. I love Boeing, I love Microsoft, as we all remember from his 8 years as governor. Also, it's very interesting that he spearheaded enormous tax breaks for Boeing at a time when they were busy relocating their headquarters to Chicago. And he called himself the education governor when he oversaw a government that basically saw cuts in education spending and the erosion of teacher salaries.
So, probably the inspiration for Bush calling himself the education president.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, so he is a real big, friend of big business. And if you expected labor to get a hearing in Commerce Department issues, forget it.
All right, moving on to national, and this last Tuesday, we all heard President Obama's address to Congress.
Yes, he basically was touting some of the programs he's already put into place to create jobs with the economic stimulus bill and to deal with the credit crisis through his, you know, housing plan that will help middle-class people get slightly lower interest rates but not really help people who need it, and his plan to bail out banks that refuses to recognize the problem of bank insolvency, which is what really needs to be addressed. And then, you know, he made a vague call for Congress to reform the outdated regulatory system, and then he quickly moved on because he didn't want to give any specifics or ask them to do any specific things, in spite of the fact that that's probably the single most important thing that needs to be done right now to stabilize the financial industry. He moved on. He talked at length about his budget that he was going to formally present the next day. And in his budget, there's the good with the bad. And there are some good things in there. He's got money for alternative energy, for, you know, rebuilding the national power grid, which is in shockingly bad shape. He's got money for energy efficiency and carbon caps. And yet, in his address, he said, quote, "And I believe the nation that invented the automobile cannot walk away from it." When I heard that, I had to just, my jaw dropped. I had to just say, what?
The nation that invented the automobile has a specific moral responsibility to help fix the damage.
Yeah, no. It's very clear that that's exactly what we have to do. We have to lock up the car, walk away from it. You know, so I heard that. I thought that was very funny, but it's very emblematic of what is in his budget. Some good things along with quite a few bad things. His health care proposal, for example, he says he wants to collect $634 billion over 10 years to help reform health care, and then provides no details. So basically he's saying to Congress, get me the money so that then we can do something with it, which is not, you know, I mean, that's good with bad. You know, you've got no plan. That's not very helpful.
Or at least you haven't released the plan, which again is a problem.
Which is a problem. That's right. That's right. So he's got some things in there to deal with the deficit too, and some very good things. He says he wants to end agricultural subsidies to big agribusinesses. He wants to end the no-bid contracts in Iraq. That's a good thing. He wants to get rid of waste in Medicare, which he did explain means the private insurers who have stepped in to cover people through Medicare instead of the government covering them, and that's actually cost the government more money. He wants to get rid of that Bush administration innovation, which helps private insurers but doesn't help the taxpayers or patients. And he wants to let the Bush tax cuts for people who make more than $250,000 a year, he wants those to expire. Unfortunately, they're not going to expire soon enough. They should expire. Congress should vote to repeal them as soon as possible. He's going to let them expire in 2010. And it's not getting rid of all the Bush tax cuts, just the ones for people who make over $250,000 a year. You could argue that the business tax cuts that the Bush administration introduced should also be repealed.
Yeah,
but he hasn't.
And most
done
of
that.
Those don't have sunset things that are
provisions
going to expire.
In them.
Yeah.
Yeah. But he also included some. He also, when he was talking, he talked about reforming Medicare and Social Security. And when I hear reform Social Security, that makes me nervous, especially when you're not giving any details.
And especially when you're basing on the premise that Social Security is going to go insolvent, which it is not going to do.
Right. No one has proved that. And it also begs the question, can Congress, and more importantly, will Congress approve some of the good things in his budget, like, for example, cutting the subsidies to big agribusiness? I've heard lots of presidents say they'd like that to happen. I have yet to see Congress actually do that. And one last thing about the budget, it includes a little line item for the bank bailout plan, which involves some Enron-style accounting. In the budget, it says it's only going to cost U.S. taxpayers $250 billion for his newest bank bailout plan, when in fact it involves buying up troubled assets for a total of $750 billion. How do they get away with calling it only $250 billion? Well, they say that after we buy these assets, at some unknown time in the future, we will be able to sell them for at least $500 billion. Therefore, it will only cost the taxpayers $250 billion. It's interesting because in his address, Obama made a big deal about how he was going to take the costs for the Iraq war, which Bush had separated out of the federal budget and therefore kind of hid it on the books, that he was going to take that money and put it back in the budget, and therefore there weren't going to be any more accounting tricks anymore. And then he turns around and he does this accounting trick with the bank bailout plan.
You're talking about assets that in many cases are nearly worthless.
Yeah, and the question is not when are the markets going to recover. It's if the markets will ever recover for these kinds of things like adjustable rate mortgages and risky derivatives. And that has yet to be seen. And then I wanted to talk a little bit about Obama's stress tests for banks. You look at this.
I shouldn't laugh. I really shouldn't.
Yeah, you look at this announcement, you know, that the Treasury, they're actually not the Treasury, but the Fed and the FDIC and some other regulatory bodies are going to do these stress tests for banks. And you have to just kind of shake your head and go, okay, I know this is supposed to be a confidence raiser for shareholders, you know. It's really a way for the government to show everybody that it has a plan and it's trying to do something. And then you look at the details and you see that what the stress test really is these regulators who haven't been regulating the banks very well up till now, by the way, will sit down and run a couple computer tests where they take the 20 biggest banks and they run them through two scenarios. The first scenario, which is called the baseline, assumes that gross domestic product of the United States is going to fall by 2% in 2009. That's pretty much the agreed norm right now for most economists, that unemployment will rise to 8.4% and home prices will drop 14% nationwide in 2009. That's kind of the best case scenario or the baseline scenario. The worst case isn't all that much worse. It's if gross domestic product falls 3.3%, unemployment rises to 8.9%, and that home prices will fall 22% in 2009.
Well, I think we're going to get a lot more stress than that.
Yeah, yeah. And the interesting thing is then when reporters asked them, the Treasury and Fed said that they had consulted with industry executives, banking industry executives, in designing the tests. So essentially they're saying they're meaningless because this industry is putting itself through these sort of baseline test of can we survive if the situation stays the same or is just a little bit worse than it is right now.
And it's really a very polite variation on the old thing of let's have the industry regulate itself.
Exactly.
Which is how we got in this problem in the first place.
Exactly.
Voluntary regulation does not work. In fact, Timothy Geithner came up with the line self-regulation is to regulation as self-confidence is to confidence. So they know better, but they went ahead and did it anyway.
And here I was hoping for something involving crash test dummies.
Right. And then I wanted to talk a little bit about Citigroup this week. Citigroup came to the government and over the weekend and said, we're going to fail if you don't help us. Our shareholders have punished us severely for the bailout funds you gave us before. Can you help us work out a deal with us? And the government came up with a plan this week, and they announced it on Friday. And what did it do? It made things worse. So I just want to describe what actually has happened. The prior bailouts of Citigroup basically gave them money in return for preferred shares in the bank. These preferred shares in the bank are not like regular shares, common voting shares. If you own preferred shares, you don't get a vote on like a regular shareholder does, and the company doesn't have control over how much they pay you in terms of a dividend. What it is essentially is you're putting money in, you're getting what's called a preferred share, and it pays a set dividend for a set period of time. Now the preferred shares that the government took in Citigroup were like an adjustable rate mortgage in that they started out with low teaser rates of 5%, and if the company didn't pay the loan back over a certain period of time, the rate would go up. So when shareholders looked at the fine print of that deal, they said, this isn't good, you know? We don't think Citigroup will be able to pay this back. And they punished them by selling off the stock and driving the stock price lower. So Citigroup went to the U.S. government this past week and said, help us, we need a new deal. And of course, instead of saying, sorry, we can't help you anymore, you've screwed up, you couldn't make good with the last round of money we gave you, we're going to let you fail and let the FDIC take control, and the shareholders will lose their money. But
is going to happen at some point anyway.
Right. Instead of doing that, or instead of saying, okay, we're great, you can't make it on your own, we're going to seize you, we're going to fire your upper level management, we're going to take control and basically dismantle the bank, sell off the pieces that are worth something, and make sure that people who have deposits at the bank get their insured amount, you know, but shareholders get nothing. Instead of doing those things that need to happen, what they did is they said, we're going to do this deal where we convert some of our preferred shares into common voting shares. So what they did is they took a certain amount of the preferred shares that they had purchased before, converted them into voting common shares, and this did two things. It allowed Citigroup to not have to pay that 5% dividend on the preferred shares that were converted, and because they're not paying a dividend on their common voting shares, it gave them a little extra cash flow, which was nice. However, in return, it did something really bad for the bank in that it diluted the current shareholders or the prior shareholders' ownings of the bank. And so what did they do? They freaked out. All the other shareholders freaked out and sold off their shares of Citigroup, and it punished Citigroup severely. So it drove their price even further into the basement. Their stock price is down to about $1.50 a share. And now, basically, it's put them on the edge of bankruptcy. So this deal that was supposed to save them actually was the worst of all worlds. And it was done because the Obama administration has this ideological block. It cannot do what has to be done, which is nationalize
it can't use
and or let the bank fail like it needs to. So I just wanted to talk about that a little
bit. And a lot of that is happening because the people who are running the economic policy in the Obama administration are a lot of the same people who got us into this mess in the first
place. Exactly.
Particularly during the deregulation era of the Clinton administration.
Yeah. And see, the thing is, they won't talk about nationalization because they think shareholders are going to freak. Well, shareholders are going to freak no matter what you do. They're going to freak out if you try these iffy rescue plans. They clearly did with Citigroup. They're going to freak out if you seize the bank and tell them that their shares are worth nothing anymore. They're going to freak if the bank fails and they lose their money. There's nothing you can do to save shareholders, so forget about them.
Yeah, and that's why they have all those fine commercials on for different pharmaceutical products.
Right.
All right, let's move on.
It makes life great.
International right. And Iraq.
Yeah, we had a policy announced this week by the Obama administration for the end of the Iraq war. It's an 18-month pullout of combat troops by August of 2010, and all remaining troops will, according to Obama, be out by December of 2011. So much for the billions and billions of dollars that were poured into the 14 quasi-permanent military bases that were put in the country of Iraq. It's a testimony once again that just how much money was absolutely thrown away on this war, but it is in fact in good news, and it really tells you how much the ideology around this war has shifted. That John McCain came out in favor of the plan, some of Obama's prior military advisors came out in favor of the plan. There is a politically broad spectrum of people who agree at this point that not only does the Iraq war need to end, but it needs to end soon, and it is simply hasn't become controversial, or has become non-controversial.
Yeah, but there's still even 50,000 troops in there.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's that doesn't seem like a real pullout to me. Or, I mean,
yeah, it's not a real end.
So. Yeah.
All right, moving on to Antarctica, coming to a seaport near you.
Yeah, I know there was news this week that a two to three year study of the entire western ice sheet of Antarctica is melting much, much faster than they thought. Formerly, they thought it was only the melting in Antarctica was only going on the Antarctic Peninsula, but it turns out it is going on at a much larger scale, and that by the end of the century, it will contribute to an ocean level climb of 3 to 5 feet, which is substantially higher than what folks thought just 2 years ago. And making matters worse, the ice shelves that hold these glaciers back from the sea are completely eroding. So the possibility of the melting speeding up even more is pretty good. So that was extremely bad news. It also led climate scientists to say that that people on Earth really have about only 5 or 6 more years to do something about global warming before we're stuck in a situation where we can't do much of anything to prevent severe climate change.
Yeah, when we look back at the Bush administration in the last 8 years, I think that ultimately will be their greatest crime
of the Bush administration. Yeah.
All right. Events for this week.
Several of them. Tonight from 8 to 9:30, a flashback to the 70s and a Take Back the Night March. This will be for the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, queer community. There have been a number of gay bashing incidents on Capitol Hill recently. This is a response to them. It will start at Bourne and Pike Street at the Pillars there. On Thursday, a couple of things going on from 9 a.m. on. Nicholsville, again, will be Need Help Moving. Show up to help at 45th and 15th Northeast in the U District. They'll be heading down to Bryn Mawr UMC and between Renton and Seattle. Also on Thursday, 7:30 at Town Hall, bioethicist Peter Singer will be in town, talk about his latest book. And on Friday, March 6th, from then through Sunday, Veterans for Peace will be having their regional conference. David Corton will be the keynote on Saturday. That will be at 308 4th Avenue South in Kirkland, beautiful downtown Kirkland.
Very good. Talking as we do every week with John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State comes out every couple of weeks. It's a community newspaper that has news and opinion and humor and whatever else we want to throw in there. You can find it wherever you find free publications around town, bookstores, cafes, King County Library System, etc. Or you can find it on the web at www.eatthestate.org. And we have been on the air here we're in our 13th year now, as we are 13th year publishing at KEXP. And we want to do a little nod because KEXP has been a wonderful home for us, and it's in a pledge drive now. So if you want
our spring pledge drive.
So if you want to call in in and make a gift and support Mind Over Matters and support KEXP, we would really appreciate it. Call in now, 206-903-5397 is the number, or make your gift online at kexp.org.
It doesn't take much to keep things going. So.
That's right.
Yeah, look at us.
That's right.